Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Daniel chapter 5, which I will entitle The Handwriting on the Wall. When this event took place was in the year 539 BC when the Persians wiped out the Babylonian Empire. That date is well attested. It's ironclad. It's in stone. Daniel must have written the book shortly thereafter, written the chapter shortly thereafter. So we begin now in Daniel 5, verses 1 through 4. King Belshazzar held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine in their presence. Under the influence of the wine, Belshazzar gave orders to bring in the gold and silver vessels that his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, wives, and concubines could drink from them. So they brought in the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, wives, and concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised their gods made of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. It's pretty disgusting, an orgiastic feast where people are drinking from God's holy vessels. And then they started praising their idols. It's not going to last long. First of all, who is this King Belshazzar? The meaning of the name is Bel protects the king. Of course, Bel is the famous Babylonian god. Bel is short for Baal, the Lord, Marduk, the Lord, and I think they just shorten it to Bel after a while. Now we have a question about who Belshazzar is. For a long time, he was unknown until a certain clay cylinder was found explaining who he was. So let's go through the predecessors of Belshazzar. First of all, we know that Nebuchadnezzar dies in 562 after a 43-year reign. Remember, we're now in 539. So Nebuchadnezzar dies, and then his son takes over. His son in the Bible is called Evil-Merodach. His Babylonian name was Amel-Marduk. He ruled from 642 to 640, and these dates are solid. Evil-Merodach was assassinated by his brother-in-law, Nergal-Glissar. Why? Because Evil-Merodach was so arbitrary and licentious in his rule. Now, brother-in-law Nergal-Glissar ruled for 4 years until he died a natural death in 556. He ruled from 560 to 556. Incidentally, Nergal-Glissar is mentioned in Jeremiah 39, verses 3 and 13, as Nergal-Sharezer. In 556, Nergal-Glissar's son, Labashi-Marduk, took over, but he was only a child and apparently a dimwit. He had diminished mental capacity, as Wikipedia put it. He ruled for only 9 months, at which time he was beaten to death by a gang of conspirators. So in 556, Nabonidus takes over. The conspirators appointed one of the conspirators as the king, and one of the conspirators was named Nabonidus. He ruled from 556 to 539, so he was the king who was in charge when Cyrus the Great and the Persians wiped out Babylon in 539. So then, if Nabonidus was the last king, who was this King Belshazzar? Well, he was the son of Nabonidus, and for a long time, historians and archaeologists knew that Nabonidus was said to be the last king of Babylon, not Belshazzar, so there was a problem. And of course, whenever there's a problem, it's always Daniel's fault, and he's not a prophet. He's a pious fraud. He wrote in the Maccabean era in the 2nd century B.C., Well, then the Nabonidus cylinder was discovered in the 20th century. It's now displayed in the British Museum, and it explains that Belshazzar became co-regent of the kingdom in the third year of Nabonidus' reign, which is 553 BC. He continued as co-regent till the fall of Babylon in 539. And we need to note here, Daniel calls him King Belshazzar in the first verse. The Hebrew word for king, that's Melech, can mean governor or royal prince. These governmental official titles are very, very loose when you translate. Now, why was Belshazzar in charge? Because during the last part of his reign, Nabonidus lived in Arabia and left the conduct of the kingdom of Babylon to his eldest son, Belshazzar. Nabonidus was a scholar. He was the first archaeologist. He butchered all the ancient ruins there in Babylon. But he's an interesting guy. He wasn't interested in statecraft. And that's why Belshazzar was in charge. Now, at the time of the advance of the Persian army in 539, Nabonidus had probably gone out to fight the Persian army. He had probably already been captured by the time of Belshazzar's feast. And now the Persian armies are surrounding Babylon, and they were looking for a way to get into the strongly defended city. Now, why was Belshazzar throwing a feast for 1,000 nobles in the midst of an attack by the Persians. That seems sort of counterintuitive. Well, when you consider the defensive fortifications of the city of Babylon, this becomes understandable. Using conservative calculations, the outer walls of the city of Babylon were 17 miles long, the walls were 22 feet thick, and 90 feet high. And those walls had guard towers on them, which were another 100 feet high. The city gates were made of bronze, and there was a system of inner and outer walls and inner and outer moats, which made the city extraordinarily secure. And the reason that Belshazzar most probably was having this feast is because he was hoping to boost morale in the face of the siege. He wanted to remind the guests of their previous victory over Israel. That's why they were drinking from the vessels which had been stolen in 586 when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem and burnt everything to the ground. Now, in verse 2, the Holman Christian Study Bible calls Nebuchadnezzar the predecessor of Belshazzar, and I think that's a good translation. As you can see, there were lots of people intervening between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. Nebuchadnezzar, then we got evil Merodach, then we got Nergal-Glissar, then we got Labashi Marduk, and then we got Nabonidus, and then we have Belshazzar. Unfortunately, a lot of the other translations don't translate it that way. They called Nebuchadnezzar Belshazzar's father, and that leads to confusion. Of course, father can always be used as an ancestor, although Belshazzar was not in the blood lineage of Nebuchadnezzar. He was his ancestor as king. I like predecessor the best. We go now to verse 5, Daniel 5. At the moment the fingers of a man's hand appeared and began writing on the plaster of the king's palace wall next to the lampstand. As the king watched the hand that was writing, we'll stop it right there. This is the famous handwriting on the wall. Now it says here in the Holman Christian Study Bible, the fingers of a man's hand appeared. That's using the Masoretic text. Belshazzar only saw the fingers. He didn't see the whole hand. The Septuagint, on the other hand, has the whole hand. Doesn't really matter. What was this hand? Well, I actually tried to do some research on that to see if there were any opinions on it, and nobody has any opinions on it that I could find. Everyone just assumes that this hand had to be supernatural, and I think that's entirely correct. Now, the writing on the wall is the origin of the proverb, oh, she's about to be ghosted. She sees the handwriting on the wall. It means you realize the end has come. We go now to Daniel 5, verses 6 through 9. Belshazzar's face turned pale, and his thoughts so terrified him that his hip joints shook and his knees knocked together. The king called out to bring in the mediums, Chaldeans, and astrologers. He said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this inscription and gives me its interpretation will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain around his neck and have the third highest position in the kingdom. So all the king's wise men came in, but none could read the inscription or make its interpretation known to them. Then King Belshazzar became even more terrified. His face turned pale, and his nobles were bewildered. His face turned pale. One commentator suggests that maybe Belshazzar had some conscience, despite all of his partying. I don't think so. I think he was just scared. He was terrified. He offers whoever can read the inscription the third highest position in the kingdom. Remember, Nabonidus was first, Belshazzar was second, because he was the regent. And so whoever can interpret this, and it's going to be Daniel, is going to be the third highest position in the kingdom. A lot of good it did. The kingdom's about to go down that very night. Now, here's a good application point. What is the point of getting worldly honors when the form of this world is passing away? What good does it do to be a big shot in a destroyed earthly kingdom? Now, in verse 7, the king called out the mediums, Chaldeans, and astrologers. Remember, Chaldeans is used in the book of Daniel, not as a reference to an ethnic group of Babylonians. It refers to astrologers, mediums, soothsayers, diviner priests, whatever you want to call them, demon chasers. Belshazzar said to these wise men of Babylon, they're also called wise men. I don't know why. They weren't wise. They never interpret a dream. They never interpret the handwriting on the wall. Why purple? Why a gold chain is offered to the man who can interpret this inscription? It's because purple is traditionally associated with rule, royalty. Gold chain sounds like Daniel would be having a midlife crisis. But no, a gold chain is a symbol of authority. And so in verse 8, the king's wise men came in. No doubt they were thinking, well, maybe we can get some wealth here. Maybe we can get some honor. Apparently they were not at the feast when the handwriting appeared on the wall. But none of these wise men could read the inscription or make known the interpretation. Now, there are lots of reasons suggested by the learned commentators as to why nobody could read the inscription. Adam Clark says it's because it was written in Hebrew, and of course they weren't Jewish. I don't think so. Most people think it was written in Aramaic. Joseph Benson mentions an option. He says that perhaps it's because the handwriting was written in ancient Sumerian characters, which was unlike the Babylonian script. So there's two things that could be a problem. What language is it in, and what script was it written in? Script is not the same as language. French and English use the same script, the alphabet, A through Z, but of course the language is different. Ellicott suggests maybe the characters were in the old Semitic script, whatever that is, I don't know. Maybe the script was a script known to the Babylonians, but maybe the language was not. Now, Zondervan Academic, in an article written by Wendy L. Witter, says that it was Aramaic, but without vowels. Witter says that the reason the handwriting was difficult to read, even though it was Aramaic and everybody knew Aramaic, was because there were no spaces between all the letters and words. And believe me, not putting spaces between the words does make something hard to read. And remember, it was dark in there. This handwriting was by the lampstand. And a website called Chaim Ben Torah, a Jewish website, says that it is unlikely Belshazzar or those of his royal court really took time to learn to read Aramaic. They had scribes and magicians that could do that. Well, perhaps the nobles could read it, but they were scared as to what it might mean. Perhaps everybody could read it, but nobody knew what it meant. We'll talk about what mene, tekel, uparsin, what it means in just a minute. It's not an easy subject, but for whatever reason, the people at the feast couldn't make out what the meaning of this writing on the wall was. So we go to Daniel 5, verses 10 through 12. Because of the outcry of the king and his nobles, the queen came to the banquet hall. May the king live forever, she said. Don't let your thoughts terrify you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the days of your predecessor, he was found to have insight, intelligence, and wisdom, the predecessor being Nebuchadnezzar, of course. Wisdom like the wisdom of the gods. Your predecessor, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the diviners, mediums, Chaldeans, and astrologers. The god prophet was ahead of the demon prophet. Your own predecessor, the king, that's Nebuchadnezzar, did this because Daniel, the one the king named Belteshazzar, was found to have an extraordinary spirit, knowledge, and perception, and the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems. Therefore, summon Daniel, and he will give the interpretation. Now, this queen who came in was probably the queen mother, Belshazzar's mother. She's hard to identify with certainty, so we don't know. Now, Daniel wasn't there at the feast, naturally. He wouldn't be at a feast mocking the conquest of the Israelites, where people are drinking out of the vessels of Yahweh's temple. And he wasn't called at first, and that's kind of interesting because Daniel was in charge of all the other diviners, mediums, Chaldeans, and astrologers. Why might that be? Well, one option is that Daniel was semi-retired. He was still holding a government office yet, but he was out of the loop, not involved. I think a better suggestion is that the Babylonian conjurers still didn't like him. They never called him to interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dreams either. Nebuchadnezzar said he had 10 times more sense than they did. Why would they like him? But the queen mother, or the queen, whoever she is, she respected him enough by what he said. He has ability and extraordinary spirit, knowledge, and perception. She used Daniel's Jewish name, which showed respect for him. She mentions that Daniel had interpreted dreams before. Daniel had interpreted 2 major dreams at the request of Nebuchadnezzar, the 4 metal statue in chapter 2 and the tree stump that turned into a man thinking he was a cow for 7 years, namely Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel had done that, so he had a track record. We go now to Daniel chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. Then Daniel was brought before the king. The king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the Judean exiles that my predecessor, the king, brought from Judah, that's Nebuchadnezzar, who brought Daniel to Babylon in 605 BC. Verse 14, Belshazzar continues, I've heard that you have the spirit of the gods in you. Of course, they don't say the spirit of Yahweh. It's the spirit of the gods. Not really true. And that you have insight, intelligence, and extraordinary wisdom. Now the wise men and mediums were brought before me to read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they cannot give its interpretation. So when all else fails, when the demons fail you, turn to God. However, Belshazzar continues, I have heard about you that you could give interpretations and solve problems. Therefore, if you can read this inscription and give me its interpretation, you will be clothed in purple, have a gold chain around your neck, and have the third highest position in the kingdom, all of which I suspect Daniel didn't give a rip about, especially since he's going to know very shortly when he interprets that handwriting on the wall that Babylon is history. This is the last night of Babylon. Who cares if you got a gold chain from the regent of Babylon? Who cares if you're clothed in purple and your kingdom has been conquered? So Daniel was ignored while the party was going on, but then they brought him in. Pagans under judgment oftentimes will turn to those in whom they see God, and that's true. Help me, pray for me. Now in verse 14, Belshazzar said that he had heard that Daniel had the spirit of gods. Either he had heard that a long time ago from Daniel's reputation, or he had just now heard it from the queen mother. I need to be careful about calling her the queen mother. It doesn't say she was the queen mother. It says the queen. We go now to Daniel 5, verses 17 through 23. Then Daniel answered the king, you may keep your gifts. See, I told you, Daniel didn't really care about the gold chain and the purple robe. You may keep your gifts and give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription for the king and make the interpretation known to him. Your Majesty, the Most High God, gave sovereignty, greatness, glory, and majesty to your predecessor Nebuchadnezzar. Because of the greatness he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages were terrified and fearful of him. He killed anyone he wanted and kept alive anyone he wanted. He exalted anyone he wanted and humbled anyone he wanted. But when his heart was exalted and his spirit became arrogant, he was deposed from his royal throne and his glory was taken from him. Of course, Daniel is mentioning that because there was a very proud regent right in front of him. And Daniel is saying, look, Nebuchadnezzar was a bigger shot than you are, and he got taken down to the grass as a cow. Guess what's going to happen to you, Belshazzar? Daniel continues in verse 21. Nebuchadnezzar was driven away from people. His mind was like an animal's. He lived with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with dew from the sky. Until he acknowledged that the Most High God is ruler over the kingdom of men and sets anyone he wants over it. So the boanthropy didn't disappear until Nebuchadnezzar acknowledged God. Now, a thought just crossed my mind. How did Nebuchadnezzar do that when he was a cow, or thought he was a cow? I guess he had a moment of lucidity, and he decided that, okay, God, I got it. I was a cow for 7 years. I'm going to give you praise now. So now, using that as an object lesson, Daniel turns to Belshazzar, verse 22. But you, his successor, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this about Nebuchadnezzar. Instead, you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. The vessels from his house were brought to you, and as you and your nobles, wives, and concubines drank wine from them, you praised the gods made of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or understand. But you have not glorified the God who holds your life breath in his hand, and who controls the whole course of your life. Ooh. Daniel was a brave ambassador of Yahweh. He knew how to speak truth to power. He did it to Nebuchadnezzar, and now he's doing the same thing to Belshazzar. Now note the difference in Daniel's attitude toward Belshazzar as compared to Daniel's attitude to Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 4, verse 19, we see that Daniel was troubled about having to give Nebuchadnezzar the bad news. He said, oh, I wish this bad news would be for your enemies and not for you, Nebuchadnezzar. But Daniel was not so impressed with Belshazzar. Keep your gifts. Now, Belshazzar was a proud man. Daniel says in verse 22, Belshazzar had not humbled his heart, and Belshazzar had no excuse for the doom he was facing. He should have known if he had submitted to the God of the universe. There's no excuse. And I might note that every unconverted man in the United States of America and Western Europe has more knowledge than Belshazzar did, every man and woman. Every person has more knowledge than Belshazzar did about God. And yet, America and Western Europe is now post-Christian. They are without excuse, and they're heading for the same fate, either individually or nationally or culturally, that Belshazzar faced. We go now to Daniel 5, verses 24 through 28. Daniel continues, "Therefore he," that's Yahweh, "sent the hand, and this writing was inscribed. This is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parsin. This is the interpretation of the message. Mene means that God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel means that you have been weighed in the balance and found deficient. Peres means that your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians." Now, we need to look at this inscription on the wall. This is not an easy subject because it involves knowledge of ancient languages, namely Hebrew and Aramaic, of which I don't have much. I did start studying Hebrew about a month ago just for occasions such as this. So let me say that Mene, Mene, Tekel, Uparsin has created a lot of scholarly discussion as to what was on the wall and how it was interpreted by Daniel. Well, we see that the words are mentioned in two different places. In verse 25, Daniel tells Belshazzar, "This is the writing, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parsin." And then in verse 26, 27, and 28, he interprets the words. Verse 26, Mene, verse 27, Tekel, and verse 28, Peres. Peres, by the way, is the singular of Parsin. And so I think the majority of commentators that I was able to explore say that Daniel took the consonants on the wall. It was Aramaic, according to the majority. Aramaic doesn't have consonants, just like Hebrew didn't have consonants. And so Daniel, in verse 25, read out the writing with consonants that make the interpretation, or make the translation, I should say, a mina, a mina, a shekel, and two half pieces. Now, mene has different vowel pointings when you want to make it say a mina, a monetary unit, and when you want to make it a verb that says he is numbered. And so in verse 25, Daniel reads it as a mina, and in verse 26, he interprets it by changing the vowels and says, "This means that God has numbered the days of your kingdom." God is numbered. Now, tekel, which most of the commentators, not all, but most of the commentators say means a shekel, tekel, Daniel translated as he has weighed, and of course Belshazzar came up light. And tekel, the three consonants of tekel, the root, is used both for shekel and for weigh. I looked at my Hebrew text and the pointing is the same. I would have thought the pointing, the vowel pointing would have been different, but it's not, but I can't go into that. ReadingActs.com, a website discussing this, says that the root of tekel means to weigh. And tekel has the same root when it means shekel. So, Wikipedia says that Daniel took the consonants on the walls and he added vowels so that the words could be translated as verbs. Now, this interpretation was first suggested in 1886 by a scholar named Clermont Ganneau, and it's currently accepted by many scholars according to ReadingActs.com. Now, there are lots of other complicated interpretations that I ran across. These interpretations are based on plays on words between Aramaic or Babylonian and Hebrew, and it's way over my head. So I'm going to go with the standard view here. So let me restate it. In verse 25, Daniel reads off the words, and he reads it like this. Mene is a mina, 60 shekels. A tekel is a shekel, and a parsin is a half piece. And, of course, it's plural, so half pieces. And so Daniel reads that, and the crowd, even if they had read it that way, might think, well, what in the world does that mean? A mina, a shekel, and two half pieces? It means nothing. So even if they could read it, they would be confused. But then Daniel takes the three words and turns them into verbs. Mene in verse 26, tekel in verse 27, and peres in verse 28. So mene in verse 26 is to number. Now, what does that mean? Daniel says, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Okay. Now think about it. Even if they, the Babylonians, looking at that inscription and had understood numbered, weighed, and divided, they might not have understood exactly what that meant. Daniel makes it clear. It means, verse 26, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Verse 27, to kale means that you have been weighed in the balance and found deficient. And pares means that your kingdom has been divided. Now he goes from parsine, half pieces. Pares has exact same three consonants in the root. And you come up with divide, and you leave off the plural ending, and you come up with the kingdom has been divided. So Daniel changes the text a little bit. Parsine had a shuruk, which is a form of the conjunctive wow in front of it. The Holman Christian Study Bible, and transliterating it, leaves that out and just says parsine. Most of the other translations have uparsine. Doesn't matter. It's just parsine. And then when Daniel made it singular, it came up with pares. And why did he do that? Well, it makes a great play on words with the Persians. It means divided. And guess who's going to be dividing it? The Medes and the Persians. And so Daniel says in verse 28, pares means that your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So that's the best I can do with the language at my current stage of ignorance, but I think that makes a lot of sense. Actually, it's sort of irrelevant. The point is that the message was given to Belshazzar that you're toast, buddy, you and your kingdom. We go now to verse 29 of Daniel 5. Then Belshazzar gave an order, and they clothed Daniel in purple, placed a gold chain around his neck, and issued a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. And again, Daniel didn't care about that. He said, keep your stuff. I don't want it. But Belshazzar gave it to him. Anyway, why did Belshazzar reward Daniel for such harsh words? Well, first of all, Belshazzar knew Daniel was right, so he tried to do what was best under the inevitable circumstances. Belshazzar would have lost a lot of face in front of all the guests if he had not carried out his promise. One commentator suggested that Belshazzar disbelieved Daniel and didn't believe that the kingdom was going down that night. So Belshazzar promoted Daniel in mockery, making fun of him. I don't believe that. I think he was serious as he could be. We go now to Daniel 5, verses 30 through 31, and we will finish this chapter. That very night, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. Now, this is a great story how the Persians, under a military officer of Cyrus the Great, they dammed up the Euphrates River right above the city as the water was flowing toward the city. The Euphrates River actually flowed under a gate. So to get into Babylon, you would have to be able to swim up the river, hold your breath, go down and go under the gate, which of course was impossible. But what the Persians did is they dammed up the Euphrates River upstream. And so the riverbed going up to the gate was dry, and they marched under the gate, and that was the end of Babylon. It's a great story. And then Belshazzar got exterminated that night. He was killed. And so in verse 31, Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. Now, this verse 31 has occasioned a lot of comment in the war between the late-date liberals who say that Daniel was written as history as a pious fraud in the 2nd century B.C. in the Maccabean period versus the people who are correct who say that Daniel was a prophet writing in the 6th century B.C. The reason is nobody knows who Darius the Mede is. Daniel knew who he was. He even gave his age. Well, there are two views on what it is. From the conservative viewpoint, I lean toward the Gleason Archer view, which says that a general or a military officer in the Persian army who is known in secular sources as Gubaru was Darius the Mede. Now, here are some big heavy hitter scholars who hold that view. Robert Dick Wilson, Gleason Archer, William F. Albright, Friedrich Delitzsch, that's Colin Delitzsch, Delitzsch, and John C. Whitcomb of the Genesis Flood fame. So these are some heavy hitters. Now, on a website called BibleHistory.net, we read that the Babylonian Chronicles, that's an historic record of what happened in Babylon, written by the Babylonians themselves. The Babylonian Chronicles tell us the exact date which Babylon fell, October the 13th, 539 B.C., according to historical records, a man named Gubaru, a Mede, was appointed by King Cyrus to be ruler in Babylon at this time. Now, Gubaru was born in 601 B.C. That would make him 62 years old when he invaded Babylon, which is exactly the age that's stated in Daniel 5:31. How did Gubaru get the name Darius the Mede? Well, Many historians believe that the name Darius or Darius was not a proper name at all, but a title of honor meaning holder of the scepter. In other words, the phrase Darius the Mede should read like this, the scepter holder of the Medes, or the king of the Medes. Now, there's an alternate conservative view as to who Darius the Mede is. That view holds that Darius the Mede is another name for Cyrus. I'm not going to get into that view, but there are some scholars who hold this view. D.J. Wiseman, Joyce Baldwin, and Stephen Miller. They're not quite as weighty as the conservative scholars on Gleason Archer's side, who say it's Gubaru the Mede. But the arguments are very interesting. We don't have time to go into them. If you want a good summary of the two views, you can look at the website www.evidenceunseen.com. If you really want to have a good time looking at the debates between liberals and conservatives and how you should interpret the scriptures, this issue of when Daniel was written, in my opinion, is the best place to go to. You can see what liberals do to avoid prophecy, and you can see how conservatives can defend very, very well with historical evidence that Daniel wrote the book. At any rate, we are finished with the handwriting on the wall in chapter 5, and we are now prepared to go to chapter 6, which contains the familiar story of Daniel in the lion's den. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.